So I call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:04 p.m. on Thursday, March 23, 2023. We're meeting today in the Davis Conference Room 106 of the Capitol Building and ask that you please silence your cell phones out of courtesy to others like that. So, committee members in attendance today are Representative Sumner, Representative Sadler, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Vina, okay, and myself, the chair, Representative Prox. So we have a quorum to do business, and welcome to all of those who are joining us today. And I'd like to introduce my committee aide, Riley Nye. To my right, your left, our returning House Records reporter, Suniva St. Clair, and Zach Lawhorn, our teleconference moderator. We have three items on the agenda today. The first is the confirmation of the governor's appointee, Heidi Hedberg, to the Commissioner of Department of Health. We have HB 112, the profession of pharmacy. This will be the first hearing on that bill. And we have some invited testimony. And HB 60, the title is Runaway. They didn't set that up alphabetically. It is the cleanup bill for the splitting of the Department of Health and Family and Community Services. So with that, first order of business is the confirmation of a governor's appointee, Heidi Hedberg, who is a commissioner designee of the Department of Health. And Commissioner Designee Hedberg, if you would please come forward and position yourself under the bright light and introduce yourself for the record and explain your qualifications for this position.
For the record, Heidi Hedberg, Commissioner Designee, and I want to take this opportunity and thank you for considering me for the role of Commissioner for the Department of Health. What I'd like to do is share just a little bit about myself, about my work experiences that have prepared me for this role and the vision for the next 4 years for the Department of Health. I was born in Utah and I was raised in Seattle. And when I was in high school, I was an exchange student to Denmark, and I still remain very close with my host family. And in 1995, I moved out to Alaska to attend Alaska Pacific University, where I graduated with an outdoor studies degree. That degree taught me leadership, team building, crisis management, and risk management. And several years after college, my husband and I, we paid off all of our student debt and we saved up some money and we traveled around the world for 8 months. And we traveled and we hiked and we climbed and we explored wonderful rivers and communities and mountains. And it was fantastic. My husband is born and raised in Alaska and we have two boys who are very active, one who loves rock climbing and one who loves biking. And we love to spend our summer weekends in Prince William Sound on our boat. So that's a little bit about me. So prior to my state service, I spent 13 years working in the nonprofit sector. And it was through those experiences that really offered the opportunity to really travel out to rural communities. And I forged a lot of relationships as I was traveling across the state. And I carried those relationships with me through to today. It was from my years working at the Girl Scouts where I was empowering girls to lead through volunteer activities and directing programs through working and recruiting and training adults to mentor teenagers in student ministries at a large church through learning how to make blood components and oversee and project management of large projects at the blood bank. all of those experiences working at the nonprofit has really helped me and really shown the Alaskan ways and really different perspectives of the healthcare system. For the past 13 years, and yes, it's 13 and 13, I met that magic mark this year, so 26 years of work experience. But the past 13 years, I have worked in the Division of Public Health. And I started at the bottom and really worked my way up. And it was through those various jobs that I was really able to learn how state government works from different perspectives. And again, I think that has gained, I've gained more insight into how government operations work. The last 4 years, I was the director of public health. And while I was in that position, I represented the department in unified command, and that was along with the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management and the Department of Public Safety for the COVID-19 pandemic response. Leading through that global pandemic, dealing with conflict and adversity, and managing scarce resources, and overseeing a team that was exhausted and burnt out was a significant challenge. It required a strong network of connections across the state, the ability to really quickly assess information as it was coming in, to triage priorities, and really an understanding of how state government works to get things done quickly during the pandemic. It also required the ability to greet every day with optimism and create an environment where teamwork and partnerships was the key to success, because there was no one agency or no one person that could do it all. Being the director of public health and helping lead the COVID-19 pandemic response was one of the most fulfilling jobs, and it really stretched me to do things that do not come naturally to me, but I really did lean in with my faith. I am incredibly thankful for the staff and the partners that really positioned Alaska to fare much better compared to rural states. Alaska had fewer hospitalizations and fewer deaths compared to other rural states. And it was through our partnerships with our tribal health organizations that really allowed Alaska to be ranked number one for vaccinations per capita when the vaccine became available for COVID at the beginning of December of 2020. So it's really through these work experiences that have shaped my life and prepared me for this new role. And now as I look to the next 4 years, my vision for the Department of Health is really the health, the well-being, and the self-sufficiency of Alaskans. This is going to be achieved by leveraging public health as the chief health strategist. It's addressing the inefficient systems within public assistance and addressing the gaps in the behavioral health continuum of care and caring for the ability to age in place and focusing on timely reimbursements for Medicaid providers. It's with these desired outcomes that Alaskans will be healthier, our economy will be more vibrant, and the healthcare system will be more accessible and affordable. That's my vision. So a little bit diving into that vision. Public health has the strategies to better the health of Alaskans and communities. This is the Healthy Alaskans 2030 State Health Improvement Plan. We know that prevention is cheaper than treatment and is a cost containment tool over time. And it's through this plan and highlighting what are the most significant health issues and working towards addressing those significant health issues that is really going to make Alaskans healthier and, again, drive down those costs. The Division of Public Assistance is at a low point, and this is not a reflection of the dedicated staff that are trying their hardest, but this is really a reflection of these inefficient systems. The historical challenges have spanned multiple administrations and has negatively impacted Alaskans. And while I cannot control the past, I can take responsibility now and better steward these resources moving forward. I recognize that the IT systems need to be integrated and we have a plan. I recognize that we have a workflow management tool and we are leveraging to fully operationalize that so that we can be more efficient with our staff and our processes. All of this is affordable because of the department reorganization. I have a smaller span of control, and so I'm better positioned in order to support the Division of Public Assistance. When I look back over time and I reflect on the behavioral health continuum of care, I see that we have made a lot of progress, but we actually have a long ways to go. There are still gaps in the behavioral health continuum of care. I am thankful for the Division of Behavioral Health leadership team and the commissioner's team, and I want to continue to support them as they are addressing the gaps in the behavioral health continuum of care. Last year's passage of House Bill 172, which was the crisis now, really afforded and addressed one of those gaps. And now what we need to do over the next 4 years is to fully implement those services across the state and really focusing on community services so that when an Alaskan is in a behavioral health crisis, they have the right service at the right time. In addition, I just want to focus on aging in place with local resources for seniors and individuals with disabilities. That's another key to healthy families. And when I started in this position in November, I heard very loud and clear from the advocacy groups the need to update the rate setting methodologies, increase the workforce, and allow individuals with disabilities to choose their direct services. I think this is going to take a lot of work with the advocacy groups, the legislature, and the department as we work together on these changes so that we can support our most vulnerable Alaskans so they can live their highest quality life. And finally, I just want to recognize healthcare services. They touch all parts of the Medicaid program, from provider enrollment to background checks to those weekly check rights of $45 million. I have a great team, and over the past 6 years, they have been able to save $370 million in general funds through tribal reclaiming. And they have a lot of ideas on how we can expand that. And I want to support that team as we're looking at those cost-saving measures. And last but not least, my vision is really to see the governor's initiative on healthy families fully realized. Strong families, again, are the foundation for a vibrant economy and community, and it's really built on healthy communities or healthy beginnings, improving access in healthy communities. And this is going to require working with other departments, other communities, businesses, the legislature, so that we can update or have new policies and really looking at all the various funding sources so that we can really, again, support the intent behind this initiative. In closing, what I bring to this role is organizational leadership, stability, innovation, and a team approach. Healthcare is incredibly complex, and it's critical to form a team that has a wide knowledge base and skill sets that complement each other, because there's no one person that can know everything. The last 3 years have been incredibly pivotal, from living and leading through a global pandemic, working through a cyber attack and a department reorg. It's been immense, and I think it's really highlighted the strengths of the Department of Health and our areas for improvement. And my goal is that we would address those gaps and improve on those areas over the next 4 years so that we really can envision that the department's mission, which is the health, well-being, and self-sufficiency of all Alaskans. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions for Commissioner Designee Heidberg? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, I just first want to thank you for your leadership for over the past couple of years during the pandemic, and also in the past couple of months as you've led through a lot of different crises. And I appreciate you speaking upon the importance of stakeholder engagement, especially on recognizing many of these issues that Alaskans are facing that relate to DOH. So I think that with the department split, there's a lot of opportunity with a new department to really look at workforce, the workplace culture, and help increase trust in the Department of Health, rebuild those relationships. And so I'm curious if you could speak on the importance of transparency with what the department is doing, because as legislators, we want to do the best job that we can to support the work that you're doing so that we can work together to create long-term solutions for these crises.
Through the chair, Representative Mina, that's a great question around transparency. So a couple of things that I have been doing, part of it is building relationships with staff. Staff need to know what my vision is. They need to know my leadership style. And so I have been hosting town hall meetings. The department has 1,500 employees, so they're all virtual. I've held 4 town hall meetings with the Division of Public Assistance, and then I'm working through the other divisions, and then we're going to get into a regular schedule so that we have regular town hall meetings. One, so through transparency, they can see me, they can hear updates, and they can ask questions, and everyone's hearing that same message. I think when it comes to our partners, as I mentioned in my testimony, our department cannot solve healthcare or reform healthcare on our own. We need to partner with our tribal health organizations, our hospitals, the federally qualified health centers, with our tribes, our businesses, leveraging public-private partnerships. And I think it's when there is something that comes up at a community level, coming together, identifying what it is and how we can all support each other, and having those honest conversations. And then again, partnering and coming to the legislature and what those policy levers are. I think that's how we build transparency, is working together in solving these problems.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Commissioner Designee Hedberg, you're sure you're up for this job? that's a rhetorical question, of course. It's a big job. Having had some experience with the previous Department of Health and Social Services, it was a massive department with tremendous responsibilities. And the more you dig in, the more there is to realize that it's been doing. That led to the division into DOH and DFCS. But my question is going to be kind of philosophical. Would like to see your thoughts on the subject. Is the Department of Health's mission still too big? I guess I want to ask the question, is it possible for one state department, regardless of how dedicated and transparent and hardworking their staff is, to meet all the needs that Alaskans have? I mean, is it still too big a job, or is it doable?
Through the chair, Representative Sutter, that's a great question. I want to just kind of ponder that for a little bit. You know, our mission is the health, the well-being, and self-sufficiency. And when I look at those three components and I reflect on the divisions within the Department of Health, I think it is rightly matched. But our department cannot do this work alone. When we think of healthcare providers, they're licensed with the Department of Commerce. When we think of from birth through our elders, we think of school age. That's our partnerships with the Department of Education. When we think of accomplishing this work, our partnerships with our business sector is critical if we're going to make changes in the workforce environment, in the business environment. And so I think that this vision, the mission is set for the department, but the key is that we need to leverage bringing in the other state agencies along with all of the stakeholders together as we're looking at how we are going to truly move forward in creating a healthy workforce, a healthy economy, because you have to have healthy people. And I think we have a wealth of subject matter experts in the department, and that's kind of where we're working all together collaboratively. Everyone brings something to the table.
Okay. I don't want to be. I don't have any questions to ask.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox, and thank you for being here today. I have to say, for the committee, just a comment, I can personally attest to what was then Director of Public Health Hedberg's work during the pandemic. I certainly appreciate your long hours and weekends worked, and I can attest to the ability that you have to build relationships throughout the state. There was a lot of stakeholders involved in that, and really the ability to roll out what in many cases was a ever-changing situation to be able to communicate clearly and directly through that. So I personally look forward to seeing what you're able to do with the Department of Health. I think to Representative Sadler's point, it is a it's a tall order. I guess my question, though, is in regards to you know, reports of I guess staff morale, and you've been speaking about these town halls and such. What sort of implementation or plan would there be to help improve some of the working environment for people that are working for the department, especially even when we have real concerns around their security at work in regards to public assistance and things of that nature? I don't know if you felt comfortable speaking on that.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, that's a great question. You know, it was really the intense hours and days and months and then years through the leading through the pandemic that really highlighted that there's many staff within the Department of Health that's just exhausted. And I have a lot of optimism. And when you bring in that energy, sometimes it can feel even worse. And so part of it is meeting staff where they're at. And part of it is, you know, as I mentioned, the town halls. My goal is, as time allows, I do want to get out to the offices to connect with staff, to hear from them. I think part of it is they just want to be able to share their concerns and know that leadership supports them, and that's through building relationships. I think when I think of our staff, I think of sort of three different areas. I think of how do we focus on the culture, the work environment. How do we ensure that our staff have the resources in order to do their job? And then I look at compensation. And compensation is not just the paycheck. Compensation is a variety of topic areas. And so I think of those three areas because all of those creates that environment where you want to go to work and you want to be able to fulfill whatever those duties are within your job. And so part of the focus that I have around morale is that connection with the staff and really listening. So the directors, the executive leadership team, we have regular meetings where we're focusing on updates, but also what's your win for the week? And then how are you supporting your staff and making sure the communication is flowing back and forth? I also look at the compensation. So again, it's not just the paycheck. It's also, you know, supporting staff if the leadership and the staff with alternate work weeks, supporting them and making sure that they have that hybrid telework schedule if that's something that is for that position. Looking at tuition reimbursement so that we're focusing on professional development. There's a program called SHARP, and it really allows for student loan repayment for those that are eligible. When SHARP 3 was passed, it also allows for hiring bonuses or retention bonuses. And so there's a lot of levers that we can pull for the retention. It also helps with the recruitment as well. And I think as we are able to fill in the ranks with our vacancies, you know, I think that will help with the retention. I think that will help with the morale. So I look at those sort of three different areas. There's a lot of work to do, but it's all about how do I support the directors and how the directors support their staff, and then how do we all come together.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Thank you. Through the chair, I really just wanted to share thanks to Commissioner Hedberg and the department and the governor for a number of things, because I've had a lot of questions for the department over the last few months, and sometimes public thanks are in order. Thank you for advancing a Healthy Families Initiative as an organizing principle that should guide our budget and policy decisions. I think if there's one principle that should guide our budget and policy decision, it is that framework, because it drives preparedness to read. It's going to drive reductions in adverse childhood experiences. It is the number one thing that we can do to cut long-term incarceration costs. So I think we should look at the budget and policy through that lens. Thank you for organizing that with the governor. I wanted to express thanks through the chair for actually engaging with stakeholders. You know, I thought when you inherited a SNAP crisis and we asked you, what do you think about these ideas from stakeholders? Your department actually responded in detail, worked on the solutions, laid them out. And, you know, sometimes bureaucracies, I think, shut down or get defensive, but your department actually engaged. And I think we heard that's been a consistent trait of how you've worked. And thank you for taking that approach. you know, through the chair, I really appreciate your leadership, the department's leadership, and thinking about how departmental infrastructure can produce long-term sustained improvements in health of kids and, again, public safety and education. And understand that we have to invest in these positions over a number of years. The savings aren't going to materialize for years, but they're the most important thing we can do. And having that long-term view is very important. As you know, I care a lot about early care and learning, and I know that you and your staff have put an immense amount of time into being proactive about that, so thank you for that. And I guess my only request going forward, you have my unequivocal support based on an incredible record. My only request going forward is to just be honest with the legislature when we have to step up. And, you know, I think back, and it was our fault we didn't replace the information technology systems that contributed to the SNAP crisis. And, you know, I was culpable for that. And if there's something like that in the future where we need to step up, just tell us, be direct. And kind of along the same lines, your department is so complex, you know, a program like the infant learning program where we have 10 years of inflation adjusted cuts. I didn't know that until this year. So please just tell us when we need to step up so that your department can perform. Because when I look at what we're not doing, a lot of the time it's as much us as the department, or it's more us. But we just need that information so we can fund your operations adequately. So thanks for all the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, definitely echo Rep. Fields' comments as well. A different topic, and I know it's not under the Department of Health, but I know the governor has the Office of Health Savings, and so I'm curious if you have any thoughts for how DOH may be a partner with that office.
So through the chair, Representative Mina, the Office of Health Savings is an ask in our budget and is within the Department of Health. Are we talking the same?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. So we are, you know, there is a lot of ideas out there on healthcare reform, cost savings, how we can make changes. I think it really boils down to bandwidth. We want to engage in these evaluations and demonstration projects, pilot projects, but it's really the bandwidth. And so the request that we have is for these physicians that can take these ideas on, scope it so that we can demonstrate that it actually works, and then see how we can expand those ideas or those projects.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Hedberg, this kind of presages my question. I was going to ask you the question. There, obviously, as Representative Fields says, there are many needs, and he's invited you to make your needs known. Given our recent revenue forecast and shortfalls, do you have any ideas and thoughts about how you might help the Department of Health operate more efficiently and at less cost? I mean, we always ask people to do more with less because we see things have less. So what are your thoughts on how you can make your department achieve its mission at lower cost and more efficiently?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, thanks for the question. Part of it is starting with a discussion with the division directors and their programs on what are budget stays, what are operational efficiencies, how can we partner with our partner organizations more, what levers can we pull in that space. I think all of that comes to a discussion within the executive leadership team. When I think of where we're at now and I look at our statistics with our data with the health Alaskans, I see increased obesity, I see increased hypertension, and I look at the cost of treatment, and then I look at the cost of prevention. I think that's where leveraging public health as that chief health strategist and really focusing in on that prevention, that's the cost containment tool over time. It's not going to be next year, but we are going to see cost savings. As an example, with the Healthy Families Initiative that was launched, we also acknowledged the Fresh Start program. The Fresh Start program is focused on adults, and it's focused on those with obesity, hypertension, and then reducing smoking. We've seen over 1,000 people that have registered with the Fresh Start program. the Fresh Start program, those three programs have been in existence. It just wasn't sort of assimilated into the Fresh Start brand. Over that lifetime of those programs since inception to date, individuals that have been enrolled have said that they've lost over 5,000 pounds. That's pretty significant. These are federally funded programs. And so it was through our staff, who are the subject matter experts, that pulled it together through looking at what our needs were. That's going to save us time as we really focus on those prevention efforts.
Representative Sumner.
So through the chair, how much are we spending on, or how much federal funds are we spending on the Fresh Start program? I was just trying to compute like a dollar cost per pound.
There. Through the chair, Representative Sumner, I don't know.
Representative Sandler.
Well, if the through the chair, at the expense, at the risk of being a little bit pointed, we've just gone through some discussions about executive compensation, and presumably you looked at the salary range offered to the commissioner. Can you work for that for the next 4 years if it shouldn't raise?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes, thank you.
Sure. Check.
Any other questions for the commissioner designee? Representative Sadler.
Sure. I appreciate that, Commissioner Designee Hedberg, that you're entering into a situation where there's lots of situations to deal with, put nicely, fires to put out, to put it more directly. If and when you're able to put out those fires, once you get to point zero level, what initiatives would you like to launch? Healthy Families is a good one. I'm sure if completing that is going to be good, but what ideas would you have if you had the opportunity to initiate them?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler, Healthy Families. There's three pillars: healthy beginnings, improving access, and healthy communities. Childcare, there's a lot of conversations, as Representative Fields mentioned, around childcare, and we need to do our homework to really get that those studies completed to make recommendations on how we can support and sustain childcare. So supporting and sustaining childcare will allow parents to enter the workforce if they choose. And so that's part of the Healthy Families Initiative. When I think of improving access, I think of that prevention. I think of behavioral health. There's so much work to unpack in those three pillars under the Healthy Families Initiative. So while I really hope we can focus on system changes in the beginning of the years, I really hope to spend a lot of time on healthy families.
Any other questions? I have a couple. Some events you remember where you're standing when you heard about the event, and when the governor announced that he was going to shut down the economy, essentially. I remember where I was standing, and I was thinking, this is going to be a whole lot worse than he thinks it's going to be. And so anyway, but I was impressed at how well the department did with standing up, with reaching the goal. The point was to emergency shut down until we established the hospital care system. And I was impressed. What did you learn? What went well? Kind of what were the things we learned from that?
To the chair, that's a great question. There's so much to unpack. I would say I remember receiving a call with the repatriation flight from Wuhan, and that was in January, and it never stopped. And March 11th, I believe, is when the governor declared an emergency, public health emergency, and you know, work just continued to escalate. From March until May, that was really where there was a novel virus. Nobody knew the science behind the transmission, and we didn't know how to protect Alaskans, and that's really where we had to pull back. The governor was very clear, and we all supported that we wanted to make sure that the economy was opened as quickly as we could, and so there was a huge amount of effort in getting personal protective equipment, making sure that we were giving guidance so that people could engage safely, because we knew the economy had to come back. I think a lot of communities took those measures, and they did what was right for their community at a community level. at a state, we really wanted to make sure that we were focusing on getting the economy back up and running, because we knew it was hard to kind of pause and it's really hard to kind of get up and running. And there was global impacts. I think the supply chain has really impacted all of the different aspects that we had to live through over the past 2 years. There was a very small team working with the governor, the prior commissioner, Adam Crum, Dr. Ann Zink. We would huddle together with our subject matter experts, and every day it was sort of triaging what we knew. It was a lot of conversations with community leaders, our tribal partners, our hospitals, just to assess what did we know, what did we have, how could we be innovative and different. It was also learning from a lot of other states on what they did and what we thought would work or wouldn't work within Alaska, and then looking at other countries and what they did. So it was, there's not one aspect. I mean, it was, I hope that answered your question, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of conversations. I think we were highly involved.
Okay, thank you. And the other side of that, that's certainly not through your fault, I don't think, but there was and still is quite a bit of lingering, in a kind word, skepticism of public health, the health system in general. Do you have any thoughts on how to go about improving that, sort of restoring that at least to some degree?
To the chair, I mean, restoring public health?
Restoring public confidence.
Thank you for the clarification. To the chair, I think that is really, I like to say, meeting people where they're at and understanding where their concerns are around public health. Public health is large and wide. There's a lot of infectious diseases. There's environmental. I mean, there's a lot of topics that impact or that are a part of public health. So first and foremost, it's understanding the topic, meeting that constituent where they're at, that community where they're at. We did a lot of listening sessions during the pandemic in person, just listening, providing updates and kind of hearing their questions. I think that's the continued work that we need to do over the coming months and years.
Thank you. And I don't know if we can get specific, but we have a bill, House Bill 80, that addresses the, restoring competency and the problem of people with mental health problems being let back out on the street. I'm guessing you have thought about that. Do you have any thoughts about how we might improve that?
To the chair, that's a great question. I am not incredibly familiar with that bill. I think that is more with family and community services.
I'm getting used to the transition. You're correct. Thank you. All right. Any other questions for the commissioner designee? All right. With that, is there anyone in the room that might have some testimony to offer, or anyone online? And if I'm working the computer right, I don't see anyone signed up. I'm not working the computer right. Yes. Yes. Please, ma'am, come forward. Ah, there we go.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Jeannie Monk, and I'm here representing the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. On behalf of AHA, I'm very pleased to have a chance to testify in support of the appointment of Commissioner Designee Heidi Hedberg. I have had the privilege of working with Commissioner Designee for the past 12 years as she has worked in multiple roles with the Department of Health. I've personally seen her commitment to the health of Alaskans and her hard work in every role she has had with the state. I really appreciate her willingness to step forward in this new role. I know it won't be easy, but I appreciate her willingness to take it on. I could share a lot of different things about her and about all of the experience I've had working with her, but I'll keep it really brief. I feel like she has a really strong team and will continue to build her team and will focus on finding solutions to the really challenging problems that she faces. I really appreciate that although she is new to her role as commissioner, she's taking ownership for the problems and is focused on solving those problems rather than pointing fingers. Part of her success, and I think she talked about this in the context of COVID, but I've seen it over many years, is her willingness to build relationships and strong partnerships to get the work done. She doesn't try to do it alone. Commissioner Designee Hedberg has been a great partner with hospitals and nursing homes for many years. We may not always agree with her decisions, but we are confident that she will be fair and that she'll involve stakeholders in the process whenever possible and that she'll focus on the best interests of Alaskans in her work. We are willing to continue to work with her and look forward to continued partnership. So I'm happy to offer our association's unwavering support for her confirmation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sorry, Rep. Sadler.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Funk, I appreciate AHA being here. I would ask kind of the same question I asked of the designee. What do you think the department's changes or mission should be, focus should be, if there's any opportunities for improvement? You're here before us. Just offer us your thoughts, please, briefly.
Yeah, well, I really support the three pillars that Commissioner Designee Hedberg talked about. We are very interested in both supporting and having a really strong healthcare system, but also looking upstream. What do we need to do to help Alaskans be as healthy as possible so they don't need our health care? And I think Heidi has a lot of great ideas in that area, and we really look forward to partnering with her. We're interested in ways we can use innovation and change our healthcare system so it works better for Alaskans. There's a lot of opportunities. It's been challenging for the past 3 years during the pandemic. We've been focusing on keeping the health system functional. And now as we really move out of it, we're looking at ways to improve. We need to strengthen our healthcare workforce across the state so we have the well-trained workforce to meet the needs. But there's a lot of opportunities around prevention and those types of activities.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Next on my list, I have Dr. Ellen Hughes from Bethel. Dr. Hughes, are you available?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Certainly. Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Ellen Hodges, and I am a family medicine physician in rural Western Alaska, and I've served this area for about the past 20 years. And I would like to thank the committee for this opportunity to speak in support of Commissioner Designee Hedberg's permanent appointment as commissioner. And I also wish to thank all of you for your service to the state of Alaska. I first met Commissioner Designee Hedberg when we were serving together on the CHAP certification board. It was immediately apparent that she was not only knowledgeable about the issues and highly professional and compassionate, but possessed an ability to look at problems and solutions from unique and collaborative perspectives. Even though some of those tasks were very tedious, she found ways to promote the development of the community health aid program and offer invaluable insight to this unique healthcare delivery model that we use here in rural Alaska. Fast forward a few years, and we found ourselves in the middle of a global pandemic with unique impacts on rural Alaska. Commissioner Designee Hedberg remained a steadfast ally and tireless advocate for rural Alaska and the needs of all Alaskans during this time. I was both a frontline provider taking care of patients and working administratively to protect a vulnerable population. And I can honestly say I could pick up my phone anytime and ask Commissioner Designee Hedberg for help or even just advice. And every single time she was there, we received people, testing supplies, PPE, and support at all levels and at all times. And times of crisis bring out the best and worst in people, and it certainly brought out the best in Commissioner Designee Hedberg. I know her job was impossible. All of us had some impossibilities in our job, but not once did her enthusiasm flag. Not once did she offer anything but the best she had to help us in our time of need. And while this may sound a little strange, she was always positive and upbeat, not whitewashing the issue or the particular crisis that we faced, but a resiliency that I needed, certainly in that difficult time period. And in this esprit de corps that we were all in this together and somehow we would come out the other side. A true beam of optimism when that was a really hard thing to find. And now we still face crises in the state in the form of a large TB outbreak, substance misuse disorders and other myriad health conditions, both chronic and acute. And it always seems to impact rural Alaska in a very unique way. I'm confident that Commissioner-designee Hedberg will continue her hard work on behalf of rural Alaska and all Alaskans. Thank you for taking the time to listen.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you. Next, we have Ron Meehan from Anchorage. Mr. Meehan, are you online with us?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you, Chair Prox and members of the House Health and Social Services Committee. My name is Ron Meehan. I am the Policy and Advocacy Manager for the Food Bank of Alaska and the Alaska Food Coalition Manager. I'm calling in today to testify in favor of Heidi Hedberg to be Commissioner for the Department of Health. Commissioner-designee Hedberg has maintained consistent communication with the Food Bank of Alaska and the Anti-Hunger Network through the current food security crisis and played an instrumental role in securing the funding for our immediate relief efforts to meet the ongoing need from the SNAP backlog. This will allow us to get pass-through funding for food and bulk food purchases to communities and into the hands of Alaskans that need it. Under her purview, the Department of Health has taken positive and necessary steps to get through the backlog, reduce the Division of Public Assistance workload, and streamline the process for clients. The Department of Health is presently facing a multifaceted and difficult situation, but Commissioner-designee Hedberg has shown up. Although there is more that needs to be done, she and her team have been working around the clock through the crisis to address the backlog. The Food Bank of Alaska supports her confirmation and looks forward to working with her in the future. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Mr. Meehan? Thank you, sir. Next on the list is Nancy Merriman from Anchorage. Ms. Merriman, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello, Representative Prox and esteemed members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Merriman, and I serve as the CEO of the Alaska Primary Care Association. APCA supports the development and operations of Alaska's 29 community health centers, also known as Federally Qualified Health Centers, or FQHCs. It's my pleasure today to express our support for Heidi Hedberg's confirmation to serve as the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health. We have appreciated her authentic partnership with us for many years on activities including emergency preparedness and management, COVID response, fostering collaboration between public health and FQHCs, and identifying new opportunities to strengthen Alaska's healthcare safety net. She has a wealth of knowledge and experience that leads to strong collaboration that's results-oriented. Second, research demonstrates and supports the value and importance of primary care, that kind of healthcare that meets patients where they are, that gets to know who they really are, and that addresses not only their medical and clinical needs, but also their social drivers of health, and connects people to resources. This is the kind of healthcare that FQHCs are committed to and live out every day for their patients. Over the course of many years of working with Commissioner Designee Hedberg, I can attest that this is also the kind of community healthcare that she believes in. She has deep awareness in the ability to improve health and wellness through affecting economic status, education, housing, and food security of all Alaskans. Ms. Hedberg's perspective gained from years in emergency preparedness and response, public health, and the breadth of state health programming and responsibilities is important and will inform her leadership and strategic planning for the Department of Health. She has seen how all the separate, distinct, and sometimes siloed pieces of state government affect Alaskans' families and have direct and indirect impacts on lives. Commissioner-designee Hedberg is a strong public health leader in Alaska, and we support her appointment as commissioner. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mina has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick comment. When I was working at the Alaska Primary Care Association, I was working on a lot of those different COVID communications on those Zoom calls and newsletters. So that is when I interfaced a lot with Commissioner Designee Hedberg. So appreciate your work with community health centers during that time.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you. Ms. Merriman. Next on our list, we have Elizabeth Ripley from Wasilla. Ms. Ripley.
Chair Prax, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Ripley, and I serve as president and CEO of the Mat-Su Health Foundation. The Mat-Su Health Foundation shares ownership in Mat-Su Regional Medical Center and invests its share of the hospital's profits back into the community through grants, scholarships, and systems change work to improve the health and wellness of Mat-Su residents. We have had the opportunity to work with Heidi Hedberg in her current and previous roles, and I'm calling today to offer our support for her confirmation. Heidi is a proven leader, as demonstrated by her work during the COVID pandemic. She dealt with constant change and stress and projected herself in a calm, reassuring way. While many directors of public health resigned during the pandemic, Heidi never wavered, even in the face of formidable challenges, exhausting hours and days, and a public that often didn't support the role of public health. She is a high-energy, experienced, and dedicated public servant who has built a very solid team around her. She is an excellent communicator, a key strength the commissioner needs to work with the many constituencies and collaboration essential to protect and grow the health of Alaskans. Upon taking her current commissioner designee role, Heidi walked into a difficult situation related to the problems with SNAP and Medicaid payments, issues highly publicized in the media. She recognized these were priority areas, leaned in, personally engaged in understanding the challenges, and is bringing resources to improve the situation so that Alaska's most vulnerable residents get the assistance they need. We look forward to working with her and her team. Please confirm Heidi Hedberg as the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Ripley? Thank you. And next on the list, we have Vern Bonner from Anchorage.
Arigate ku. Thank you, Chair Prox and Vice Chair Ruffridge and distinguished members of the committee. For the record, my name is Verne Connock Berner. I'm addressing you today on my own behalf as an Alaskan resident. I'm honored and proud to speak in support of Commissioner Designee Hedberg's confirmation as Permanent Commissioner of the Department of Health. I am a second-year PhD student in epidemiology at Johns Hopkins University. I worked with Heidi when I served as the president and CEO of the Alaska Native Health Board. My work with her was during one of the most consequential periods of my 28-year career when Alaska was leading the nation in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. I attest that Heidi demonstrated exceptional strategic thinking, honed collaborations, and effectively deployed scarce resources. She will be the first to tell you that she did not do this alone. No one could, but she maximized her personal potential impact to great effect and has helped to save precious lives. The threats to Alaskans were great, and the taxing of our collected system would have been quickly overrun and eventually was, but her insight in developing and systemizing the partnerships, particularly with the Alaska Tribal Health System, bought Alaska and Alaskans critical time needed to shore up those systems, build resources, and response teams. We were able to establish communications across numerous incident command systems, reduce duplication, and protect all Alaskans until life-protecting vaccines and life-saving therapies could be developed. In the time of great scarcity, Heidi acted quickly and decisively and worked countless hours. The collective result was putting Alaska at the top of the nation and protecting our people. Heidi is field-tested, strategic, dedicated, and effective. I support Heidi Hedberg's confirmation as Commissioner of the Department of Health.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions? Good. Thank you, Ms. Warner. I believe I mispronounced that twice. I apologize for that. And that is completes the list that I have of people that wanted to testify. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify? And is there anyone else online that would like to testify on Commissioner Designee Heidberg's appointment. Okay, thank you. So with that, public testimony is closed. And at this time, any other comments from the committee? Ms. Heidberg, did you want to make any closing comments? I have a question, and I'm not sure I've got the right reference. Have you read Ernest Hemingway's works much?
To the chair, no.
I'm not sure I have the right reference, but the quality that I think of is Grace Under Pressure. I think that was Hemingway. But thank you very much for your service and look forward to working with you over the next few years.
Well, thank you, everyone, for your kind words and for your consideration.
Okay. With that, the House Health and Social Service Committee has reviewed the qualifications of Heidi Heidberg, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Health, and forwards her nomination to the full legislature to consider for confirmation. Signing this report does not reflect any individual's recommendation of approval or disapproval. And we'll take a brief at ease while we sign the report. And we're back on record. The next order of business is House Bill 112, Profession of Pharmacy. This is the first hearing for the bill, and we'll be taking invited testimony. But first, I'd like to invite Representative Ruffridge and his staff, Braden Garrett, did I get that right, to introduce yourselves for the record and walk us through your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Prox. For the record, my name is Justin Ruffridge, I'm the representative for District 7, Kenai-Soldotna, and thank you for having a hearing on House Bill 112, an update to statutes regarding the profession of pharmacy. I'd like to introduce my staff, Braden Garrett, who will be going through the sectional analysis, which is a little bit lengthy, so apologies for that, but this bill does make a lot of conforming changes to our statutes that are needed. Also joining us today for invited testimony and the presentation you see on your screen will be given by the current chair of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy, Dr. Ashley Shaber, and we will invite her up after a brief introduction. So House Bill 112 is actually a multi-year, multi-chair, multi-board years process of updating the right touch regulations for the profession of pharmacy. Pharmacy profession has gone through a lot of changes over the course of the last 20 to 30 years, and we were tasked from the governor to update regulations to both remove and update language during that process through multiple chairs and multiple board members and iterations of the board. It came to note that there were multiple statute changes needed to make these regulation changes happen, and this is the end result of that process. There will be a testimony given from the chair of the Board of Pharmacy in regards to what those changes do and why they're important. And I will entertain questions. So if it is okay with the chair, I will have Mr. Garrett walk through the sectional and what the changes are, and then ask Dr. Shaber to give her presentation, which is just a few minutes long, and then we will be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Prox. For the record, my name is Braden Garrett, and I'll go through the sectional analysis for House Bill 112. Section 1 amends the statutes in regard to creation and membership of board officers. It alters the composition of the seven-member Board of Pharmacy by designating one member to be a licensed pharmacy tech, and one being an individual with no financial interest in the healthcare industry. Section 2 amends the Alaska statute regarding powers and duties of board with subsection B10 through 18. Subsection B10 separates out the licensing regulating entities relating to manufacturing and distributing of drugs and devices by use of the word or. B12 adds an epinephrine autoinjector training program. Subsection B14 clarifies that only pharmacists who dispense federally scheduled controlled substances be required to register with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, otherwise known as the PDMP. Subsection B16 adds pharmacies and manufacturers from out of state to the list of entities to be licensed and inspected. Subsection B17 adds internet-based pharmacies to the list of entities to be licensed if they are servicing Alaskans. And subsection B18 adds language adopting regulations pertaining to retired pharmacist status. Section 3 amends Alaska statutes that regard to reciprocity license transfer, with subsection 3 removing character requirements, quote, of good moral character, end quote, and subsection 4 removing internship details, which is a national standard among schools of pharmacy, and then it renumbers the statute items in that section. Section 4 amends Alaska statutes that regard to licensing of facilities, with subsection K reading out, this adds out-of-state pharmacies and manufacturers to the list of entities that must be licensed and inspected. Section 5 amends the statutes that pertain to licensing and inspection of facilities outside the state. It adds, quote, distributor, pharmacy, manufacturer, end quote, to those out-of-state entities that must be licensed and inspected under the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act. Section 6 amends the statute that regards licensing and inspection of facilities outside the state. It adds, quote, pharmacy and manufacturer, end quote, to list that may be inspected if located outside the state. Section 7 amends the statute regarding fees. It removes the word, quote, registration, end quote, since the bill mandates licensure of a facility. Section 8 amends the statute and adds a new subsection in regard to administration of vaccines and related emergencies. It allows a pharmacist to administer epinephrine to a person or prescribe epinephrine autoinjectors to someone who has completed the epinephrine autoinjector training program. Section 9 amends the statute that regarding executive administrator of the board. It adds an additional salary range option for the executive administrator, allowing flexibility for the division to select a pharmacist for the role. Section 10 amends the statute regarding certain advertising prohibited, which adds the term, quote, apothecary, end quote, to list of those that cannot be used in media or advertising unless the store employs a licensed pharmacist with regular hours. Section 11 amends the statute regarding national criminal history record check, and it adds pharmacist and pharmacy tech, to list of professions where a background check is required. Aligns the state of Alaska's nursing requirements and pharmacy requirements typical in other states. This adds a national level background check. Section 12 amends the statute that regards prescription purchase administration of epinephrine by a trained individual. It allows anyone over 18 to purchase or be prescribed an epinephrine autoinjector and to administer epinephrine in an emergency to another person if they have completed an epinephrine autoinjector training program approved by the board. It removes very outdated language from this section. Section 13 amends the statute regarding approval of training programs. It allows the board, rather than the department, to adopt standards for the epinephrine autoinjector training program and deletes outdated language. Section 14 amends the statute regarding approval of training programs. It allows the board rather than the department to approve an epinephrine autoinjector training program that meets the board's standards. Section 15 amends the statute regarding applicability. It states that this chapter does not apply to someone currently authorized under another law to administer epinephrine, such as a nurse or doctor or some other authorized professional. Section 16 amends the statute regarding liability or certified individual. It outlines that a person may not be sued who administers epinephrine to another in an emergency and in good faith if he or she has completed the epinephrine autoinjector training program approved by the board. Section 17 amends the statute regarding definitions. It defines the, quote, board, end quote, as the Board of Pharmacy. Section 18 repeals the statute regarding qualifications for licensure by examination. It repeals subsection 2, which furnishes the board with at least two affidavits from reputable citizens that the applicant has known for at least 1 year, attesting to the applicant's good moral character. This is not required in medical board, dental, or nursing statutes. It repeals the statute on registration of pharmacies located outside the state, since this bill would now require licensure. Repeals the statute subsection C, which is the department's epinephrine auto-injector training program. And it repeals the Alaska statute for subsection 1 that defines the department as the Department of Health, since it will no longer be the approving entity of the epinephrine auto-injector training program. Section 19 is transition language for currently registered pharmacies. It is a new section that would allow pharmacies previously registered to continue to ship, mail, or deliver prescription drugs to its customers in Alaska until their registration expires. At that time, they will then have to apply for licensure. Section 20 is also transition regulations. It allows the Board of Pharmacy and the DCCED to adopt regulations to carry out the changes laid out in this legislation. Section 20 has an immediate effective date under the Alaska statute laid out. Subsection C. Section 22 also has an effective date that is set to coincide with the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act that will go into effect on November 26 of 2023. Thank you, Chair Prox.
Thank you. And did you want to take questions now, or did you want to?
If it is okay with the chair, I would like to invite Dr. Shaver up to do the presentation, and then her and I can stand for questions. For the record, Dr. Shaver is a much better pharmacist than I am, and so that is the reason why she is here to give the presentation today.
I've heard that.
Thank you.
Hey, Dr. Shaver, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Prox. For the record, my name is Ashley Shaver. I am the current chair of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy, and I'm here today on behalf of the Board of Pharmacy. I appreciate the time. So the first slide in front of you today, I wanted to take just a moment and talk a little bit about the Board of Pharmacy and the reason the Board of Pharmacy exists. Our mission is to promote, preserve, and protect the public health, safety, and welfare through the effective control and regulation of the practice of pharmacy. And really, when we look at the changes in House Bill 112, those changes are related to guiding principle number 4, regulation and enforcement, specifically 4.1, routinely reviewing effectiveness of regulations that reduce barriers to license without compromising health and safety. 4.4, which is advocating for legislation as the pharmacy profession evolves and new opportunities for improved patient safety arise. And 4.5, anticipating changes to the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act and responding proactively. Representative Ruffridge talked a little bit about the background of House Bill 112. Just to reiterate, this is something that the Board of Pharmacy has been working on for many years. It has spanned multiple boards, multiple chairs, and it really is an overview and recommendations of statute changes to ensure that the board can continue to meet its mission. The changes can be divided essentially into 4 pillars. So those are the pillars that you see in front of you. Streamlining the license process while improving public safety, complying with the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act, alignment with other professional boards here in Alaska and pharmacy boards in other states, and clarification of pharmacist roles and epinephrine access. And I want to point out today to the committee that this has been a collaborative effort, not only over multiple boards of pharmacy, but also with the Alaska Pharmacists Association. And both the Board of Pharmacy and the Alaska Pharmacists Association do support this bill. So the first goal in terms of streamlining the license process while improving public safety The first point here is that it eliminates unnecessary forms. So you heard in the sectional analysis that there are some forms that are required to attest to a licensee applicant's moral character. Those are redundant forms. That is covered in other areas of the license process. So when the division goes through and assesses the licensee, that part is already covered. So that is redundant. There's also clarification that only pharmacists who dispense controlled substances are required to register with the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. Currently, our licensees have to attest to that, and that is additional paperwork that has to be processed in order for them not to register with the PDMP. So this is clarification that they don't need to register if they don't dispense controlled substances. And the last change here is adding a national criminal background check. So currently, Board of Pharmacy or pharmacist licensees and pharmacy technician licensees go through a state-level background check. And the board has discussed for many years that a national background check would add an additional level of protection and add an additional level of safety for Alaskans that receive services from our pharmacists and our pharmacy technicians. Pharmacists and pharmacy technicians regularly handle controlled substances, and this is one of the reasons why the board feels that a national background check would be beneficial. Currently, the process relies on license actions in other states and licensee applicants, the word that they put on their application. They attest to any license actions in other states. The national criminal background check is required in 30 other states. So this would put us in alignment with the majority of other states. The next goal is compliance with the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act. So this is a piece of federal legislation that is in place to secure our drug supply, ultimately to ensure that our patients receive safe medications that are not contaminated, that are not counterfeit. And as we've learned more about the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act over the last couple years, we've realized that boards of pharmacy play a key role in this process. And that's through appropriate licensing of drug distributors and pharmacies and manufacturers. So you'll see the changes in House Bill 145 align with this to ensure that the Board of Pharmacy can properly support the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act, with the ultimate goal to ensure that Alaskans receive safe medications. The next goal is alignment. So the first bullet here talks about the change here to replace one of the two public member seats with a pharmacy technician seat. Currently, the Board of Pharmacy has 7 members, 5 pharmacists and 2 public members. This change would replace one of the public members with a pharmacy technician seat. This is also in line with multiple other states that have at least one, sometimes 2 pharmacy technicians on their board. And it's an important voice to ensure that that aspect is brought forward in decision making. The next change is to allow the board to adopt language for retired pharmacist status. So currently, if a pharmacist completes their career and they're ready to retire here in Alaska, their only option is to allow their license to lapse. This allows them to officially retire their license. It's an additional recognition for the time that they've served our Alaskans. It is in line with other state boards, the medical board, the nursing board, and the chiropractic board, for example. And it's also in line with other states that allow that. And the last change here is to clarify that the board executive administrator's salary, or to make a clarification for the board of executive administrator salary, with the ultimate goal to allow flexibility for a pharmacist to serve in that role in the future. So currently, the salary is much lower than what a pharmacist would make, and so that's limiting to having a pharmacist serve in that role. The board did not want to require a pharmacist to serve in that work role. We wanted to have the option. So this clarification allows for that flexibility. This is also in line with about 50% of other states that either require or have a pharmacist in their executive administrator role.
The next goal is epinephrine access. So the first change is moving the epinephrine training program that's currently in Alaska statutes from the Department of Health under the Board of Pharmacy. This is something that's been in statute for a while, and the Board of Pharmacy is willing to take on the oversight of that training program. The other change here is to clarify that a pharmacist can administer epinephrine to a person or prescribe epinephrine auto-injectors to someone who has completed that training program. So if you have someone who has completed that training program, they're in need of an epinephrine pen, they can go to any pharmacy in Alaska that is willing to prescribe epinephrine auto-injectors to those folks. So that's ultimately increasing epinephrine access for our Alaskans that either have anaphylaxis, known or unknown. And I want to point out that this is similar to the model that we have in place for naloxone, where pharmacists can prescribe naloxone and have that access available. And it's also in line with a couple other states that have put similar changes in place. So I want to close today respectfully requesting your support for House Bill 112, allowing us to further support our mission for the Board of Pharmacy, and I really appreciate your time today.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions for Ms. Shaver? Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to Ms. Shaver and Representative Ruffridge for writing this bill. And I do have some questions that maybe fit within the bill, but also reach a little broader, just about thinking about best serving Alaskans. And glad we have a lot of expertise on the committee to do that. So who or what type of person do you envision as being an individual with no financial interest in the healthcare industry? Is that kind of seen as a consumer advocate?
Through the chair, I would say that that currently is in statute. That's a public member, has no financial interest in the healthcare industry, so they can't work for a pharmacy, they can't work for a hospital, and ultimately bring that public consumer perspective to the board.
Okay, and if I could ask a follow-up, what are the requirements right now to be on the board?
Through the chair, are you asking for the requirements for a pharmacist or a public?
In the respective positions. Like, are there any, so yes, are there any additional requirements other than just being a member of the public?
I would need to defer to the division the statutes to be entirely sure. I know that the no financial interest is the biggest from a public member perspective, willing to commit to quarterly meetings and commit to the work that is involved is definitely something that's required as well.
Yeah, and through the chair, so currently there are two public member positions on the board, only one of which is currently filled and has just recently been filled. It's been somewhat difficult to get public members to serve on the board for that, I think, the time commitment requirement. And it's not something that people are going online to boards and commissions and just wishing to serve on the Board of Pharmacy as a public member in a profession they don't necessarily know about. So this bill would actually change one of those public member positions to a technician position. So you would really just have that one position, which is now currently filled.
Through the chair, I like that idea, and that does lead to another question, if I might ask about it.
Refused.
Farm techs are actually an important job for people, I think. Kind of a potentially good middle class job, and it makes me wonder, what do you see as the role of the board in supporting training, promoting training, including for farm techs? I realize that may be a little bit beyond the scope of the bill, but I don't know if it's something that you thought about in looking at the role of the Board of Pharmacy.
Yeah, through the chair, that actually, Representative Fields, was a large item of interest during my time serving on the Board of Pharmacy. We promoted and actually passed regulations to add a certified pharmacy technician as a specific type of individual recognized in our regulatory practice, which is sort of that next step of pharmacy technician work. where you there is a test. There's different levels of education that are required. Currently, a certified pharmacy technician in this state has the ability to do final checks on prescriptions if those prescriptions have been previously done, had a drug utilization review done by a pharmacist. They're able to go through training to administer vaccinations. There really is a concerted effort in the industry to promote pharmacy technicians as being that sort of middle step. The board has taken a lot of steps to ensure that that is something that we want to promote. There's not necessarily statute change that needs to be exerted in order for that to be done, but the board has in the past and currently promoted pharmacy technician work.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, to either the sponsor or Dr. Shaver. It seems that, if there's four pharmacists on the board right now and potentially a pharmacy tech member of the board and one public member, it would seem to me that the executive director would not be necessary for the executive director to be a pharmacist. That position is more of an administrative and paperwork kind of function, I would think. So what is the need to have the executive director have the potential of being a pharmacist, a licensed pharmacist?
Through the chair, to Representative Sadler, I'll start and then I'll let Dr. Shaver put forward her experiences with this. In my time as a pharmacist and as a board member and previous chair of the Board of Pharmacy, there is a lot of work to be the executive administrator of the Board of Pharmacy. And you are expected, at least our executive administrator was and still is, expected to have, in some cases, a very deep level or almost an institutional knowledge about not only what the department requires for licensing, but also requirements that are very much profession-driven. And so a lot of questions get directed to the executive administrator from outside groups, from different entities requiring answers to licensing questions as well as professional level questions. And so there's a disconnect sometimes in being able to answer some of those questions because that individual serving as the executive administrator does not have professional level knowledge of the pharmacy profession. And so they have to wait for a board meeting in order to have answers or reach out to the current chair to get answers to some of these more professional level questions. It seemed in my experience that a pharmacist serving in that role, which as Dr. Shaver mentioned, is actually current practice in many, many states, helps lead the profession in a direction and does not present a barrier to quick answers for questions as well as promotion of the profession throughout the state. So hope that answers your question, and I'm sure you probably have some follow-up to that.
Yes, through the chair, I will add that our five pharmacists that are on the board are all volunteer. They do work full-time, and so to add to what Representative Ruffridge was referring to, those questions that arise, those complicated technical professional questions that arise, many of our board members just simply don't have the time to address that. And so it's volunteer time, it's on their own. And so having a professional in that role would really support the board as well.
Sure. Thank you. You know, we have the director of boards and commissions in the audience, and at some time in the proceedings, I will ask her about whether the board of medical board and the board nursing and real estate examiners, if they also have licensed or fully qualified professionals in their executive support positions. I can see the advantages, but there's a cost to that.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I have a separate question related to the regulation of out-of-state entities that are added here. So how are these regulated in the status quo?
Thank you. Through the chair, to Representative Mina. Well, they're not. They are required currently to register in our state, just to essentially let us know that they exist on some sort of level. But the Board of Pharmacy, if they are dispensing or providing services into the state really has no option to protect or promote the safety and well-being of Alaskan patients because we don't currently license those entities. But Dr. Shaver can probably add more to that answer.
Yes, to add to that through the chair.
If I can interrupt you, I'm forgetting that I'm supposed to ask you to identify yourself again for the record each time. I'm not good at that either, but it helps our recorder.
Through the chair and for the record, this is Ashley Shaper, chair of the Board of Pharmacy. And the change in House Bill 112 gives the Alaska Board of Pharmacy the oversight. As Representative Ruffridge mentioned, currently it's a registration. It's simply an acknowledgement that they're providing services. But if there were to be a safety concern brought forward, if a patient in Alaska were to be harmed as a result of the services provided by that pharmacy, the Board of Pharmacy would have no oversight of that out-of-state pharmacy.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, could you characterize or contextualize some of these out-of-state entities? How prevalent are they, and what types of businesses are they?
Through the chair, and for the record, this is Ashley Shaver, Representative Mina. There, some of the examples include mail order pharmacies, providing mailed prescriptions to patients. Some of these out-of-state pharmacies are compounding pharmacies that provide either sterile or non-sterile compound medications, eye drops, for example, injections to our patients here in Alaska. Those are some examples.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Fields.
Thanks. I appreciate kind of y'all being available to provide expertise on some issues maybe a little bit beyond the bill. We've heard some about fentanyl being in adulterated drugs. What is your take on what the public should know, what we should know, how are pharmacies adapting to this? Is this a reality we're going to see in the future and we should think about in the context of a board update?
Yeah. Thank you through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, for the record. Certainly a very large concern to Representative Fields' question, but has always been the concern actually of the board, of pharmacy and pharmacists in general. Fentanyl is just one of a line of adulterated or counterfeit types of medications that we've seen throughout at least my time as a pharmacist. It's one of the reasons why the Drug Supply Chain Act on the federal level was instituted to really have a better or more clear picture of what our drug supply chain looks like. Because adulterated medications, although fentanyl is highly dangerous and highly potent and is often fatal, we see adulterated medications actually being sent into our state and people taking adulterated medications more often from internet pharmacies in some cases, purchasing drugs from out of country or having drugs shipped into country. And so, there is a concern about that and wanting to ensure that we have, statute update in this bill, particularly to comply with some of those requirements inside of that federal regulation. So a concern, absolutely always been a concern, and we continue to try to promote safe access to medications. But I don't know if you had anything to add to that.
Through the chair, this is Ashley Shaver for the record, Representative Fields. Just to add to that, the importance of being able to have board oversight of internet pharmacies is one way that this bill could potentially address some of that concern. Additionally, the access to naloxone, which has already been in place for several years, is one way that the Board of Pharmacy helps ensure that is in the forefront of our minds.
Thank you. If I could ask one more broad question that may be or may not be addressed by this bill. So, being a parent and having kids who get sick makes me experience and think about how gaps in primary care can lead to more expensive care sometimes. An example we've run into as a family is when your kid develops respiratory distress at night or on the weekend and you end up in the ER, it's a $4,000 bill versus you know, a primary care visit. And, you know, just thinking about that as an example, are there opportunities for the Board of Pharmacy potentially to work with other primary healthcare providers to try to reduce those gaps in the primary care system and, you know, maybe reduce the incidence of people resorting to the most expensive care? And I haven't thought through what all the examples might be, and perhaps there are others out there.
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, for the record, to Representative Fields, I will answer your question, and I will give you more details later, because this is an area of passion and concern for me as a pharmacist and a state licensed pharmacist. There is an extensive number of opportunities for pharmacists and the profession of pharmacy to fill gaps in care, and we've done that. I think during the pandemic, we saw pharmacists and pharmacies across the state start to fill in roles that we didn't historically provide on a large level, and we've consistently expanded that, not ever wanting to take the role of a primary care physician, but always being ready and willing to offer what we would, I guess, on some level determine mid-level type care. There is a push nationwide for pharmacists to be given provider status, which this bill does not do. But we have taken steps in that direction over time in the state of Alaska to really promote the ability of pharmacists to take some of those steps. I think one of the things that you see in this bill is our ability to determine whether or not, just like in the case of naloxone, an individual could and should have access to life-saving medications without needing to go see a physician in order to get a prescription for that. And really being sort of that, middle option for somebody that is not an emergency room, not a primary care provider, but we can sort of fill in some of those gaps. Now, that being said, we have a significant barrier for that in the fact that pharmacy, just as a general rule, is a difficult business to be in. And we've seen lots of pharmacies across the state close and throughout the country close, just because it is there's a lot of challenges that certainly we can talk about in other pieces of legislation that might be coming forward later. But yes, that's a very good question and one that we do think a lot about.
So. Okay. Well, thanks for bringing y'all's expertise a little bit beyond the scope of the bill. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Sapper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this bill has many facets and 22 sections, and I guess I'm focusing more on the Board of Pharmacy, but we have the former and current presidents in front of us. For those of us in the committee who are not pharmacists, help me understand, if you would, the number of licensed pharmacists in Alaska, the number of licensure activities that have to happen, just to help me understand, if there's much enforcement action. I want to get some sense of the duties and responsibilities and workload of the Board of Pharmacy. Through the chair, to either.
Through the chair, this is Chair Ashley Schieber, for the record, Representative Sadler. I would have to refer to the division on the exact number of licensed pharmacists. I don't have that off the top of my head, but I can certainly get that for you. There has definitely been a challenge in ensuring that our licensees are processed quickly, and I will definitely defer to the division to speak to current staffing, previous staffing, and some of the barriers in the past and how those have been overcome.
And I could quickly, how many pharmacists, you know, I know my pharmacist in tech at home, but I don't know how many there are statewide. How big an industry is it? Roughly the number of licensees? Even a rough idea would be helpful. 1,000, 10,000?
I believe Ms. Robb is with us. And
just this many.
Sorry, I have to bring your chair.
Sorry, I'm not trying to play stump the band.
For the record, Sylvan Robb, the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing at the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development.
As of today, there are 1,049 licensed pharmacists and 1,206 licensed pharmacy technicians.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Any other questions? Rep. Sounder.
Through the chair, how many registered pharmacies are there?
Oops.
You might want to stay here.
Just trying to get an idea of how many registered pharmacies would then have to be switched over to a licensure.
Again, for the record, Sylvan Robb. Through the chair to Representative Sumner, I don't know how many pharmacies there are, but we'll get that information to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Robb? Or Ms. Robb, do you have anything to add about this bill as long as you are here?
Sorry. Mr. Chair, we're supportive of the changes that the Board of Pharmacy is interested in making. It's really their decision how they want to operate the profession of pharmacy.
Okay, thank you. And with that, any closing comments? Representative Ruffridge.
Just a thank you to the members of the committee for hearing the bill. Thank you to Dr. Shaver for flying here to help give us an introduction to the bill, as well as give some insight into what the process is currently ongoing with the current Board of Pharmacy. Certainly welcome your support. This is a good start in promoting some of the changes that have been worked on for a long time. The chair before me, I think, still lives in Poland at this point. And he would be so proud that we're here and finally bringing to bear a process that he started a number of years ago. So I don't know if Rich is listening to this or will listen, but we finally made it to at least having a bill. So he would be happy about that. So certainly I'm available for questions, and you guys know how to get a hold of me. So
hey,
can I ask another question, Chairman?
Quickly.
Thanks to the chair. I know that Representative Ruffridge had kind of told me about how some, I think, regulatory reforms around staffing could help address places where pharmacy deserts like downtown Anchorage. And I'm curious, are there other things we should be thinking about, whether in the context of this bill or otherwise, to bring more pharmacies to places that are unserved right now, which my district is largely unserved by pharmacies, which is kind of crazy when you think about how many people live there. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, for the record. Representative Fields, that's, again, a pretty detailed answer, and so a good question. Part of the barriers currently is, as we see pharmacies across the state, across the country, closing, most of that is because, one, it's a high barrier entry as far as compensation is concerned, so payroll costs are pretty high. If you notice, certain large corporate pharmacies are going through really a staff reduction, even while the numbers of prescriptions being dispensed go up. And so it becomes a very difficult, as I said before, business to operate. A lot of pharmacies operate as a net loss to large corporations because there just is not a large margin in there. So one of the big components to alter that is what we were speaking about in your answer to an earlier question, is the role of pharmacy technicians becoming more of that a manager of a pharmacy in the sense of workflow, being able to fill prescriptions, potentially verify them, and then have pharmacists be more of the clinical oversight for a pharmacy. This does allow, and a lot of states have actually pursued this a little more heavily, and this state has not necessarily gone down this road extensively. But what we were talking about previously is telepharmacies. So this allows a pharmacy to operate in a more, let's say, urban setting like downtown Anchorage, have two or three pharmacy technicians on hand, but the pharmacists themselves would be more centrally located, maybe in a larger facility.
or off-site and be able to use technology to remotely access the prescriptions that are being dispensed and verify their authenticity as well as their safety and be able to communicate with patients remotely. This is already an option that the board has. One, it is already has statute to govern it and regulations that allow for that use. One of the big barriers to that was some of the regulations needed to adjust the pharmacy technician's capacity, which the board in the last couple of years has actually changed, and that will and does open up that option for some of those pharmacy deserts. Now we just need to encourage, you know, the profession to seek out opportunities from a business perspective. So thanks.
Thank you. And with that, I think we will set this bill aside for further proceedings. And there will be an opportunity for public testimony at some point. So thank you for your presentation. We'll take a brief at ease while we prepare for the next bill. Back on record, our last order of business today is HB 60, Runaways, and it's the kind of cleanup bill from the dividing the Department of Health, our Department of Health and Social Services into the Department of Health and Family Services. And I believe we have a committee substitute. Maybe not. Maybe he's, there we go. Yes. And Mr. Vice Chair, I would entertain a motion pertaining to the committee substitute.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Health and Social Services Committee Substitute Work Order 33-GH1343/S. As the working document.
And I will object for purposes of explaining the changes and any discussion. And I'll ask our committee aide, Riley Nye, to come forward, put your name on the record, and explain the changes of this committee substitute version S.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Riley Nye. I'm staff to Representative Prox. And with your permission, I'll now explain the changes made in this committee substitute version S. The working document in front of the committee is labeled version S, and that's 33-GH1343-S. And as a reminder to the committee, HB 60 was introduced at the request of the governor to support the reorganization of the Department of Health and Social Services into the Department of Family and Community Services and Department of Health under Executive Order 121 last session. Version S amends the original version to reflect new fixes and omissions to support the reorganization. These new fixes include adding the Department of Family and Community Services to the definition of department and found in AS 1865, Section 2. Further clarification of the role of each department related to the shelters for runaways, including the confidentiality of records requested by either department. And a section that simplifies definitions and licensing statutes and removes duplicate definitions. And with that, I request that the chair invite Heather Carpenter from the Department of Family, or from the Department of Health, and Clinton Lasley with the Department of Family and Community Services to the table to go over the explanation of changes and any further questions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nye.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Department of Health.
And Clinton Lasley, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services.
Please proceed.
And Chair Prax, again, this is Heather Carpenter. I'm just going to highlight the sections that did have the changes, and there is the document that was given to you that has the explanation of changes. It clearly marks out which sections stayed the same to make that easier for you. But in this new version, we had to make several more cleanup changes as we studied the executive order more and worked with the Department of Law and found additional fixes. So Section 2 is that section that includes the need to newly identify the Department of Family and Community Services in the definition of a department. Sections 5 through 9 and really all the way up to Section 14 are relating to further clarifications about runaway shelters. After the committee, after we had our introduction, we took another look and realized we needed to clarify that a little bit more. So our Department of Law worked closely with the committee aide and Ledge Legal to really get the right fix for all of those sections. So it's all just cleanup to make sure we're clarifying which department is doing which pieces when it comes to runaway shelters. Section 16 was a change that we really made with the recommendation of Ledge Legal. We actually kind of had a duplicate definition where we said authorizing and applicable meant the same thing. They really recommended we just pick one. So that is what we did in Section 16. Section 20 is the definition change that really enacts Section 16. And then Section 21 is just another cleanup. It just repeals a piece to fully clean up that runaway shelter changes. So all of these are fairly technical in nature, but we do have the wonderful Stacy Crayley, who is the Civil Division Director at the Department of Law, if there are really questions on the changes we made in terms of runaway shelters. And Chair Prax, that covers all of the changes that we made.
Covers all of the changes. I just forgot the name I'm supposed to ask. I'm sorry. Would you please identify yourself for the record again? And is there anything that you would like to add to this bill?
Yeah. Thank you again for the record, Clint Lastly, for DFCS. No, Heather Carpenter went over all of the changes. And as Heather mentioned, we do have Stacy Crayley from the Department of Law online if there are any technical, because most of these are technical changes, if you have any questions for Ms. Crayley.
Okay. Ms. Crayley, did you have anything to add?
For the record, this is Stacy Crayley with the Civil Division of the Department of Law. Appreciate the opportunity to be here to answer questions. I have nothing to add from what Ms. Carpenter or Deputy Commissioner Lasley have just stated.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Crayley, I'm looking at the date of the CS is March 21st of this year, and there is a legal opinion by Margaret Bergerud from Ledge Council, Ledge Legal, about the potential single subject violations, which is also dated March 21st. So my question is, does this legal opinion, do you know if that applies to the CS version before us today?
Through the chair, this is Stacy Crayley, and through the chair, Representative Sadler. Yes, that memo issued by Legislative Legal relates to the CS and the overall kind of framework of HB 60.
Very good. Would you care to, through the chair, follow up? Would you care to comment on the? Well, I'm going to ask dueling lawyers here. Would you comment on the validity of the allegation presented in this legal opinion that this may likely violate the single subject provisions of our Constitution?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Sadler. While I appreciate Legislative Legal's efforts and work on this bill, I candidly and respectfully disagree with their assessment that there's a single subject issue with the CS. As you can see through the title, yes, there's a number of different issues that are being articulated through the title. But if you look at the underlying theme, it all deals with the powers and duties of the Department of Health and the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. And so everything in this bill relates to the powers, duties, and responsibilities of those two departments. So I think what she was articulating it again. I have not spoken with her, and she, I believe, is on the line or might be, and she can certainly tell you what she was thinking. But, you know, one of the concerns that was raised was, you know, the references to, like, the Mental Health Trust Authority. Well, the change in this CS clearly articulates, and if from the executive order last year, there was an issue with who was going to be on the advisory council for the Mental Health Trust Authority. And so at the advice of Legislative Legal last year, we picked a particular commissioner because they said we could not add a member to an advisory board because that would be a substantive change in nature, and that is not allowed under an executive order rule. So we picked a commissioner for that purpose with the express understanding that we would need to come back this year and do a bill to articulate how these two departments interact with the Mental Health Trust Authority. So we're not making any substantive changes to the Mental Health Trust statutes or operations or anything like that. We are basically articulating that these two departments, which have critical roles in the Mental Health Trust authority and programs, both need to be involved as advisory members to that board. So I think it's ultimately at the end of the day, every provision in this bill relates to the operations of these two departments and how they meet their statutory duties. And so I don't see this being a single subject issue as much as just being these two departments do a wide range of things. And it was very evident in the length and the breadth of the executive order that went out last year. So I respectfully disagree that this is a single subject issue, and I don't see any problems with the bill as it's drafted.
Quick follow-up on that topic. Thank you, through the chair. So it's always usually get these kind of issues resolved at the front end instead of having legislation passed and having or trying to insert a severability clause, and et cetera. I would hope to get a meeting. I hope that you two would get a meeting together to try and figure out and try to hash out the legal issues so that the department's work does not get hung up on that severability issue, or the single subject issue. So I'm not going to get in the middle of two lawyers, but I hope we can resolve that before we try and pass the bill off. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sumner.
So through the chair, the Constitution actually reads every bill should be confined to one subject unless it's an appropriation bill or one codifying, revising, or rearranging existing laws. So I kind of think that the executive order, I mean, in fact, we have separated these two and we are now codifying that. So I'm not sure that that would actually be applicable in this case. That would be, maybe legal has an opinion, but.
Does anybody want to take that on? We also, it looks like we have a Robert Knave online from Anchorage from questions.
Chair Prax, again, Heather Carpenter. Bobby Knave is with our healthcare facility licensing section, so he is there if there are questions on, really in particular, how we license runaway shelters, just so the committee's aware of his expertise.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Chair Pratt?
Please, this must be Ms. Crayley.
Yeah, this is Stacey Crayley again. In response to the previous comment, I think that's a very salient point to be made with respect to the issue on single subject. The power to split the department is clearly authorized by the Constitution. It was clear, and we conveyed last year, that we would need to make some very minor technical changes because you are not able to amend an executive order in any way, shape, or form during that process. This bill is basically a cleanup bill. So the point that was just made regarding single subject and the idea that we are, cleaning up this executive order is well taken and appreciated. I think that was a very salient point to raise.
Okay. Rep. Sumner?
I have no
problem. Okay. Okay. Are there any other questions? All right. I would withdraw my objection. Are there further objections to adopting this committee substitute? Seeing none, the committee Seeing no objections, a committee substitute for House Bill 60, version 33-GH1343/S is adopted. And I guess we could ask for more discussion. Lots of opportunities to discuss. With that, I would entertain a motion to move this out of committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move the committee substitute for House Bill 60, version 33-GH1343/S from committee with attached individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
And is there any objection? Seeing none, the committee substitute for House Bill 60 moves from committee. And we will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Back on record, are there any comments, closing comments from committee members? And with that, we will adjourn at 5:06 p.m.